Our next guest on Downtown burst onto the music scene in early 1977 with a song that rose to the top 10 and remains a staple of rock stations. Talking, of course, about Year of the Cat from Al Stewart.
On a morning from a Bogart movie, in a country where they turn back time, you go strolling through the crowd like Pete DeLauro contemplating a crime.
When we caught up with Al Stewart at his home in California to talk about the making of Year of the Cat and much more from his long career in the business, well, we caught him actually in the middle of writing a song.
It's probably on my calendar. I was, oddly enough, midway through writing a set of lyrics, and it got away from me, but I see it on the calendar.
All right. I hope I didn't interrupt the creative process here.
Well, I've covered 2.5 pages of lyrics here. I tend to write too many words. I think I could pause for a moment. I think I know where I'm going with it, so I can probably pick it back up again.
All right. Let's begin, if we can, Al, by going back to the very beginnings. You've been playing music a long time, and you began as a rocker, but I understand that you took some inspiration in an interesting way from Bob Dylan, both as a songwriter, but also because of, dare we say, the quality of his singing voice.
Yes, I did begin when the Beatles happened in England. I think probably almost every other kid joined a band. I mean, there were called beat groups in those days, and there were about 80 in the town that I lived in. The problem was, I mean, I joined one just like everybody else, and we would play Twist and Shout 3 times a night and Wipeout and all these things that were popular. And eventually I got a tape recorder, and I was, I don't know, 17 or something, and I was beginning to write songs. And I taped myself, and I sounded awful. And the other problem was that, you know, you had to play the guitar. And within a couple of years of that period, you had Jimmy Page and Eric Clapton and Jeff Beck and all those people. And I couldn't really play the guitar well enough. I couldn't sing either. And then I made the mistake of looking in the mirror, and I did not look like Elvis Presley. didn't sound like Paul McCartney. I mean, the whole thing was a disaster. I mean, I was 17 years old, and the only thing that I truly loved in life was, you know, this music. And I realized I wasn't very good at it. And that's a crushing blow, you know. I mean, it's like if you only have one thing in life that you love and want to do, and you realize that you're really not any good at it. It makes you want to throw yourself off a building, I think. So at this very moment, who should come along but Bob Dylan? And I bought his first couple of albums, and you know, he sang like a farmhand, and this was absolutely wonderful because he wrote like you know, a great poet. And I thought, well, you know, there's another way to crack this thing. It's a dilemma, but it can be done. Maybe it can be done, you know, by writing lyrics. I mean, it had never occurred to me before because rock and roll is, you know, it's visceral. It's all about the sound. It's about the beat. It's about being young and enthusiastic. And Dylan's singing, I don't know, Hard Rain's Gonna Fall or Masters of War or these things. And they're very long and they're very complicated. And it's done just, you know, with a handful of chords, 3 or 4 chords. Musically, it's incredibly simple, but lyrically, it's incredibly dense. So I did a complete about face and sold my electric guitar and went up to London and started singing, being a folk singer in coffee bars. And I thought I would do it for a while and see what it was like. And at the same time, I was auditioning for different bands. I auditioned for a band called the Paramounts, and they turned into Procol Harum, but I didn't get the job. So that's it. I became a folk singer by default. I found myself living in an apartment with Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel at one point, and that was really helpful because I was watching how Paul wrote songs, and I thought, oh, that's how you do it, you know? And I met Bert Jantz and people like that from the early folk scene. And in the beginning of 1965, I basically was still trying to join rock and roll bands, and I thought the folk thing might be you know, it might be an interesting sideline. But by the end of 1965, I had sold my electric guitar and I was a folk singer, and that was it. It changed my life. And it was all because I couldn't play or sing.
You came out with your first album, Bedsitter Images, 1967. Now, you also worked with Yoko along the way before she and John Lennon even knew each other. Is that right?
Yeah, I met both of them before they knew each other. It's an interesting thing. I'd met John Lennon briefly backstage at a Beatle concert, and he was very nice. He let me play his guitar. And then, I think it was 1966, I was in London, and I met Yoko Ono and became a co-producer of one of her movies, Film Number 4. If you actually look at it, I don't think anyone has seen this. It's such an obscure thing. But I think I'm still listed in the credits as a co-producer. And anyway, I started hanging out with Yoko because I had a tape recorder. And Yoko was, you know, beginning to do her projects, her musical projects. And so I could play the guitar, too, somewhat. So I would tune the guitar to modal D and start playing Indian ragas, and Yoko would chant over the top of it. And this went on for, I don't know, 6 months or so. We did it, you know, maybe a couple of times a week. And I ended up with, like, about 6 hours of Yoko and me. And then, as I say it, one day she met a man with a bigger tape recorder. This, of course, was John Lennon. And after that, I didn't see her again. So, you know, that was an interesting period of my life.
We're talking with Al Stewart here on Downtown. Next to music, another great passion of yours was history, and you brought those two together in 1973 with the album Past, Present, and Future, and found this wonderful niche that really was not being filled when it comes to historical songwriting.
No, it of course it goes back to you know, through thousands and thousands of years. It probably is the earliest form of songwriting. People would write about people would write about the Peloponnesian War, and then they would travel around ancient Greece from village to village singing songs about the heroes of the day. And it fell out. It was like that for a very long time, and then it fell out of favor, I think, in the last century. And you know, historical ballads disappeared, but they were always there up until that time. So it's not something I invented. It's just something I revived. I think people have developed shorter and shorter attention spans and tend to write in, you know, very limited hieroglyphical ways. And I think back, a century ago, maybe a little more, women, well-bred women would get up in the morning and they would spend 2 hours composing letters. And these letters were absolutely beautifully done. I mean, the choice of language was wonderful if you read them now. And the calligraphy was wonderful. And, they're small masterpieces. And this entire writing style has vanished from the modern world. It just isn't there anymore. And people use shorthand to communicate with each other, you know, over cell phones. And there's something about that period and the periods immediately before it, which is immensely appealing to me. I mean, people joke that I write my songs on parchment by candlelight with a quill pen. And it's half true that I do. I mean, I mentally do that, and I think I would actually enjoy doing that. It's just that things aren't written that way anymore. Anyway, so I decided I would write historical songs, and I would bring back some of the drama of yesteryear in the writing style.
Well, and the first song of yours that I was drawn to as a young man and was from that album was Warren Harding. How did you come to write a song about one of our, well, let's just say, least effective American presidents?
Well, at some point in my life, I had studied all the American presidents, and I discovered that I found the bad ones more simpatico, really, than the good ones. I always actually enjoyed, the bad ones because some of them were so crazy and, as you say, ineffectual. I mean, I like Franklin Pierce. What can I tell you? I mean, he's the only one that looks like a rock star. He kind of looks like an older Brian Ferry.
His
little quirks. And Warren Harding, you know, presided over Prohibition, so the song actually is partly about Prohibition, and it's partly about, the crazy life and the untimely death that he had.
A couple of years later, you teamed up with Alan Parsons for Modern Times. What was that collaboration like?
Well, it was it came about very quickly. We were having dinner in a restaurant, and Alan is very understated. And we were talking about, well, actually, we're talking about wine, because that's what we always talk about when we get together. And I believe that we were drinking a 1966 Chateau Palmer. I mean, I have an almost photographic memory of every bottle of wine that I've ever drunk and with who. Anyway, that is by the by. And during the course of discussing the Palmer, I said, I'm making a new record. Would you like to produce it? And it took about 5 seconds. Alan thought about it, and he said, oh, all right. And then we went back to talking about wine. It was really that simple.
Well, the song that, of course, exploded on the scene here in America, although it was never a hit back in England or in the United Kingdom at all, was Year of the Cat. Now, am I right that when you wrote that song originally, they were completely different lyrics?
Yeah, one of the things I do, because I write so many words, I've written 2.5 pages of lyrics already today, and it's only 10 o'clock here, so I just write lots of words. So think about a blues player. Think about a lead guitar player in a blues band. What you do is they make the backing track, you know, the bass, the drums, keyboards, whatever. And then the guitar player goes out into the studio, and he'll make, oh, I don't know, 10, 20, 30 passes at the solo. And, you know, the producer listens to all the different things that he's done and picks the ones that he thinks is would be right for the song, would be the, you know, the great guitar solo. So a musician will do that. A musician will do, you know, lots and lots of passes at the music, trying to get something perfect or something special. And how I work is exactly the opposite way. We knock out the backing tracks. We did the whole of the Year of the Cat record with no lyrics. Literally, I hadn't written them. We just went in and we recorded, I don't know, 40 minutes of music. And I took all the tracks home, and then I would write. You know, I'd get up in the morning, I would write different sets of lyrics to everything. So some of those songs had 3 or 4 completely different sets of lyrics. Or if a song had 4 verses, I would write 12 verses. And then I would weed through it and throw away the ones that I didn't, you know, particularly like. And oddly enough, I'd go back and look at them now, and I probably chose all the wrong ones. But there are, yeah, I mean, there's an entire set of lyrics for Year of the Cat called Foot of the Stage, about an English comedian. And I'd seen this comedian shortly before he committed suicide, and I knew something was terribly wrong. The audience were laughing because they thought it was all part of the show. And so I wrote this song, and it went, his tears fell down like rain at the foot of the stage. And that's what it was called. And then somewhere along the line, I had a girlfriend who had a book on Vietnamese astrology. And it was open at a chapter called The Year of the Cat. So I just watched the Casablanca movie, so I launched into a completely different set of lyrics, and I wasn't sure which one to pick. But the American record company said, well, we've never heard of this English comedian, so let's have it Year of the Cat. But it could easily have been Foot of the Stage. I mean, I have alternate lyrics for tons of different songs. You know, it's just how I work.
Now, is it true that you weren't crazy about the saxophone that was added to the song?
Well, I just didn't think a saxophone belonged in folk rock. I mean, folk rock to me is, you know, guitar, bass, drums. You know, that's what it is, you know. And a saxophone to me was a jazz instrument, and I didn't think it belonged in a song in that style. But Alan convinced me that it was a good idea, and of course it was a good idea because people like it. But I was doing jangle folk rock, you know, like the right. Birds, Simon and Garfunkel, and saxophones just seemed like out of place with what I was doing. But obviously, you know, I guess Alan was right about it.
Well, Year of the Cat was hugely successful, as was the follow-up album, Time Passages. Was there any sense to you or the producers or the record company that you needed to make radio-friendly songs after the success of Year of the Cat?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, it brought out a little devilish impulse in me because Clive Davis, who was the head of Arista Records that released Time Passages, had more or less decided that this is what we should do. We should, you know, have mid-tempo ballads with saxophones on them. And if we did this, we could keep doing this. So they would make the charts. And I found this very distressing. I mean, I wanted to go back to writing my historical songs, and I wasn't at all sure about all this pop star business. It seemed a little, it just seemed a little shallow to me. So in order to annoy Clive and get him off the subject, I actually literally wrote a song to be played on the radio and called it Song on the Radio.
Knowing, of course, that radio people are so vain that we will play anything if it's got radio in it, even better if it's a good song.
The stupid thing actually made the top 30. It was a minor hit. But that was just me being, I don't know, it was me trying to, you know, sort of get out of all of this, really. And of course, I got myself deeper into it.
Well, you went on to make up more albums that were, I think, in keeping with your musical sensibilities. And one of my absolute favorites came out in the mid-90s as a history teacher and a lover of history. One of my favorite albums of yours is Between the Wars.
Yes, I like that. I was kind of influenced by Django Reinhardt a little bit. Mm. I was, at the time, I mean, I tend to live in different periods of time on different days. I'll wake up and spend the whole day in like 1648 or something, and it just, you know, I'll just be there. I won't be in the modern world at all. And at the time I was in the 30s, I was reading a whole series of books by Alan First, who's a brilliant writer who sets most of his spy novels, really, in the 1930s, in most of it in Eastern Europe. And so I was knee-deep in the 1930s and started writing these songs. And before I knew where I was, I had an album. And because it was all set between the wars, that's what I called it.
You continue to tour extensively. You've also got a wonderful DVD out live at Carmel by the Sea and a chance to reunite with old friend Peter White.
Yeah, that DVD, I don't really know much about that. I had a friend who had a camera. I mean, it's not really a very professional thing. He just set up a camera and recorded the show. And because I don't play with Peter that often anymore, you know, I thought the fans might like it. So somebody put it out.
And you'll also be here in the East for a few shows. It'll be good to have you here on the right side of the country.
Well, you know, I play everywhere all the time. I mean, it's shocking to me. I mean, I thought that, I tell you, when I was at school, when I was 17, that my parents and my school teachers gave me a stern lecture about, you know, about music and about trying to make a career in it. And they said the whole thing was a fad and it would be over in it would be over in 6 months. And I thought, well, I've got to leave school immediately. If I'm only going to be able to do this for 6 months, I'd better get started. The incredible thing was that the advice they gave me coincided exactly with the release of the first single by a group from Liverpool called The Beatles. So they could not have been more right. It would be technically impossible for all the adults in my life at the time to have been more wrong. I mean, they were just completely 180 degrees wrong about everything. So here I am half a century later, and I'm still doing the thing that they said would only last 6 months. And there's something absolutely divine about all of this. I have a couple of children, and I'm absolutely resolute in not giving them any advice whatsoever, because all the advice I got when I was young was wrong.
Well, we're very glad it was, and we're still enjoying the music all these years later.
Yeah, well, I'm writing about the Siberian dilemma at the moment. Do you know what that is?
Well, I'm not sure. Which Siberian dilemma?
Oh, there only is one as far as I know, and it's this. Periodically, you know, when the springtime, when the ice begins to melt over the freezing water, people fall in. They fall through the ice, and they fall into this very, very cold water. And the Siberian dilemma is this. If you fall in, you are going to freeze to death in basically 1 minute. I mean, that's it. You've got 1 minute to live. But if every impulse you have wants you to climb out. But if you do climb out and you're soaking wet in the freezing air, you die in 30 seconds. So the Siberian dilemma is, do you stay in and live a little bit longer, or do you try and climb out? And this is what I'm trying to write about at this very moment.
I can't wait to hear the finished product. It sounds wonderful.
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll see. I've covered 2.5 pages, and I'm not done yet. So,
well, we'll let you get back to it. Al, thank you so much. We wish you continued success and good health.
Thanks.
That was fun. Al Stewart, we recorded that yesterday from his home in California. What an interesting guy.
Yeah, and just one great story after another. And the guy knows how to write a line, because the stories, just each one of them had that exclamation point
The
end.
Yeah.
It was just beautiful.
The Siberian Dilemma.
Yes.
I want to hear that song when it's done.